Time once again for the SAFTAcast. It's time once again for the SAFTAcast with yours truly, Scott. See, you know, I've been thinking a lot today about the Army. Folks, we got a lot to talk about, so let me start flapping my gums, flapping my jaws, or whatever that phrase is. I don't even know anymore. We got a bunch of things to talk about today, from the Sundress Academy for the Arts and even the SAFTAcast. Let's just jump right into it, shall we? August 17th, that is this coming Sunday. It is the first of the occasional salon from Firefly Farms and the Sundress Academy for the Arts. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, this is an extension of the award-winning SAFTA reading series. The Sundress Academy for the Arts is going to be hosting an occasional salon, a holler salon, as they call it, at the holler. Well, down in the holler. At Firefly Farms, just outside Knoxville. This first one is entitled, or subtitled, however you want to call it, Art, Myth, and Martians. This time out, special guests include visiting poet Laura Madeline Weissman and local Knoxville artist Chris Johnson. Now, what is a salon exactly? Well, it's basically, let's get a bunch of writers, artists, thinkers, gather them in a room, and just talk about whatever may happen. It's kind of like the SAFTAcast, except it's a little more streamlined, talking about art and about philosophy of art and those sort of things. They're taking it old school here. You haven't heard of this in a long time. And if you are in the Knoxville area, you should definitely drop on by, especially because, as I understand it, the cost is free. Yes, it is. Free to talk to artists about art and about philosophy? What could be awesomer? Well, how about this? Let me throw this at you. 8 divided by 2 is 4, and that equals 824, which equals August 24. Just 1 week later, it is the SAFTA workshop entitled Not About, But Through, Poems in Response to Photos. And this is not taking place at Firefly Farms. Oh no, this is taking place at the Knoxville Museum of Art. Indeed, from 1 to 5 p.m., you can join poet Deborah Bernhardt and SAFTA members for a gallery walkthrough of the museum's exhibit, The World Is Not My Home, Danny Lyon's photographs, and then talk about poems and write poems about different ways of seeing things, about ways of thinking about objects in new ways, about places. This is going to be really cool. For the complete rundown of information, as well as registration information and all that good stuff, visit the store at sundresspublications.com. All you have to do is just go to that website, sundresspublications.com, click on the store, and then you could hit the cut link at the top to send you right to the bottom of the page, but I encourage you to scroll down the page so you can see all of the Sundress things that are available for purchase, including the naming rights to chickens, books, and the workshops there at the bottom. You can sign up, register for this. This is going to be an amazing one. I wish I could be there, but unfortunately, I am booked on the 24th for another engagement, so I cannot be there. You should be, though. Take my place, please. It's like that old Jack Benny joke, or Henny Youngman. I think it was Henny Youngman who did that joke, not Jack Benny. Take my place, please. Anyway, some interesting stuff about the SAFTAcast. If you have not visited the SAFTAcast website in a while, which is kind of strange, I don't know how you'd be listening to the show in the past without that, but in any case, if you haven't stopped by in a while, you would probably see that some things have changed, some small things have changed. One is that now all episodes, all past episodes and things are streaming. You can stream them right there on the website, through your browser, or whatever. Of course, I'm still including the direct download links for you so that you can take them and put them on your hard drive and play them when your friends come over or whatever, you know. Yeah, I don't know, some people like to do that. Or you're like me and you're just weird and you like to use an iPod still in your car and such. You know, you can do that. But here's a great thing, though. This is the big news I want to share with you. If you haven't heard about it before, you're going to hear it right now. The SAFTAcast is now available on iTunes. Yes, iOS users rejoice, because we are on iTunes. So if you have an iOS device, Apple, or you prefer to use iTunes for your listening pleasures, all you have to do is just go onto iTunes, go to the store, find us by searching SAFTAcast, and we are there. Subscribe to our feed, and you'll be able to get all the previous episodes and everything. Now, don't worry, they're not going to go anywhere elsewhere. I'm also going to keep them updated on the website, on the past episodes place, so you'll still be able to get those there and everything, but we are now on iTunes. Folks, if you really like this show, do us a solid. Go onto the iTunes store there and consider, and don't just consider, do it. Rate us, give us a review. We love it when you give us a rating or a review. We would love to see it because, folks, we are building a podcast of extraordinary magnitude, and we forge our show in the tradition of our ancestors. Go and review us. You have our gratitude. One more thing about the Sundress Academy for the Arts podcast, otherwise known as the SAFTAcast. Beginning next week, we will be moving our release days. We're going to move our schedule to Wednesdays for the foreseeable future, for Wednesdays. We're still going to deliver content on a weekly basis, if not faster. We're still going to give you the stuff you've come to expect from us and more, but we're just moving it 24 hours. It's still going to update 11 a.m. Eastern time, so you can get right at it. 11:01, you can start downloading the latest thing, whatever, or listen to it. It's right there. But we're just moving it over to Wednesday, beginning next week. So if you go on Tuesday and you're like, hey, Scott C., who's on the show next week? I have no idea. I'm just going to be like, wait 24 hours and you'll find out. Now, speaking of the show today, episode 11, hoo boy, we have a great one for you. Sandy Marchetti, poet, editor, awesome, awesome person is on the program today. And yeah, we don't even talk really about poetry or editing. We talk about baseball, the great American pastime. Specifically, we're going to talk about the Cubs and a little bit about the Dodgers. And we're going to talk about not only the Cubs and baseball, but we talk about football as well. So if you have been waiting for a podcast episode that is going to deal with sports, here it is for you, folks. But first, will you please rise? Gentlemen, remove your hats for our national theme song. Hey, Sandy, welcome to the program.
Nice to see you, or talk to you at least.
Agreed. So I'm going to start right out of the gate with the burning question that is on everybody's mind right now.
Tell me, talk to me.
All right, you ready for this?
I think I am.
Okay, here's the burning question that is on everybody's mind right now. Why the hell were three men in a tub? Seriously, I've been trying to figure this one out now for a while.
What I'd say is they were probably really good friends and they didn't expect it to happen. They were a little bit lonely, possibly.
Possibly.
But, you know, maybe the people that they normally get in the tub with weren't around.
Could be.
Could have been a long distance relationship situation.
Could have been a drunken frat party.
Yeah. It was comforting at the time. And then in the morning, one of them found out, you know, I really don't know how I allowed this to happen. Someone else was missing a kidney. By the end of it, really just, it became an epic frat party legendary story.
My guess is it's the candlestick maker that had that thought. I never trusted that guy.
For sure.
Indeed. So how are you doing?
I'm doing really good. How are you?
I am fairly well. Fairly well indeed.
Fairly well, then.
Indeed. Fare thee well and fairly well. You know, it goes back and forth like that, you know?
It's busy. It's busy right now. I was listening to your last episode with Corinna, and
oh, yes.
You guys were talking about being busy. And it's so odd because it's the summer, and we're both in academics in one way or another, and it's not supposed to be busy right now. We're supposed to be on a porch someplace with a book, with a cup of coffee that I see you drinking in this picture in front of me.
And currently I have another cup of coffee sitting in front of me, you know.
But it's decaf, right?
No, it is not, actually.
Okay. This time it's not.
This is full-blooded right now.
All right. You're going to need that because you're going to have to contain me on this thing, and that's going to be hard.
Well, I don't know about that. I've never seen myself as much of a containment field.
Okay. All right. That's good. That's good to hear.
Exactly. So what's going on that's so busy in your world?
Well, I'm doing a bunch of things. A lot of them are related to writing, so I'm a little worried about talking about that.
Okay, well, let's talk about the non-work-related busy things that are going on.
I seem to be going to the post office a lot more than I have in years. I don't know what's going on with that. And the bank. It's like the 80s again, where I can't seem to do these things from my house anymore. So,
except I'm guessing a lot less cocaine and voting for Reagan.
Yes. And being born, which is what happened to me in the 80s. So there's a lot less of that. But yeah, I just seem to, I don't know. I keep seeing people in blue shirts and blue blazers at these institutions. And I'm wondering, why am I spending so much time in these lines? But it's either some sort of certified check needs to be deposited or this package. I just don't know how much postage to put on it, and I just find myself in the, you know, bowels of bureaucracy or something once again. So that's busy. again, it's kind of related to writing, so I don't want to get too much into that.
you're mailing human body parts, kidneys, yeah, you know, that sort of thing.
That's definitely happening right now. And I'm not afraid to say, I mean, I just can't do the telltale heart thing where I put them all under the floor.
Definitely not. Because you're invariably, when you clean the house to move, you're going to miss one of them. And, you know, the next people who move in, they're going to be like, what is this heart doing here? And you're going to then the police get involved. It's never a fun thing. I do not recommend the telltale heart move. No.
No, that shows that you've moved sloppily. You know, just that was a short sale. You had to get out of there.
I'm still getting calls from Mississippi about it. I am just tired of it.
I had a friend the other day. She's moving into a new house, and the entire top floor, apparently, when the previous owners moved out, they had shampooed the carpets, but they left the shampoo all over the carpet on the top floor. And so she's like walking all over this crunchy carpet, and then she goes downstairs and she's sliding on the floor with all this waxy buildup on her feet.
Crunchy carpet.
What else are these people hiding? You know, you have to ask these questions. So
I think when I leave the apartment I'm in currently, when that time comes, I'm just going to leave the bottle of shampoo on top of the carpet so they know it has been shampooed.
Yeah.
But I'll just leave the bottle there. You know.
Keep my cleaning deposit. I don't fucking care.
Here, you know, I cleaned it myself. If you want to clean it again, here's the shampoo. I left it behind for you.
Right. There you go. There you go. Self-cleaning.
There you go. You know, works out that way. No, I don't recommend the Edgar Allan Poe school of moving.
No.
It invariably goes wrong with the ravens and all the birds around, and you leave the busted palace above the doorstop. You know, it's just, it never works.
No. And you know, And things always kind of move backwards, because instead of being in IAMS, it's all in trochees and it's all messed up. So
I agree, you know, and all I can say is that you end up searching for El Dorado and you never find it.
Right. That's the thing, too. And it just becomes this, you know, total. Well, I don't want to bring in another literary reference. I was just going to bring in the tilting windmills, but then we're just really mixing ourselves up, aren't we?
Oh, no. If it's for entertainment's sake, I don't mind bringing in literature.
Right, right. And actually, that's kind of what I was worried about being on this cast, because I'm not quite sure I'm actually nerdy enough. And I mean nerdy in the greatest complimentary sense of the word.
Oh, really?
So, yes, I'm a little worried about that. Because
dare me to challenge you.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
All right. All right. I'm cracking my knuckles here. Cracking the knuckles.
Go ahead.
I'm going to throw it down on you. You ready?
Yeah, I think so.
What are the three components of the baseball triple crown?
Oh, well, that you've got batting average. You've got RBIs, or some people like to just say RBI, which bugs me. And then you've got home runs. That's the triple crown.
Okay. What constitutes an error in baseball? This is an actual question I wondered about recently.
That is what's great about baseball, and I kind of love this. I'm a big baseball fan. You must know this from asking me these questions. But anyway, this is arbitrary, and I kind of love that. There's that official scorer, usually a really old white guy, who sits in a little box in every stadium, and he kind of gets to decide if a play that has gone awry is actually scored as a hit for the offensive player, or if it's scored as an error for the defensive player. And he gets to kind of decide based on whether or not the play should have been made in normal circumstances. But this is, it's really BS, Scott, because a lot of times the guy who sits in the little box, the official scorer, is a homer. So he's obviously going to root for the home team. He's there 82 games a year. He doesn't want to lose his job. He likes it there, so he's rooting for the home team. So we see that, and that's kind of similar as far as with the umpires, too. I really didn't want them to bring in replay, because I kind of like it when the umpires get the play wrong. It's so human to me. It's so interesting. I love that they can't quite see everything, but they think they can. Plus, the replay system that they've put in places just totally sucks, so...
Well, you're talking to somebody who really doesn't follow baseball. He used to when he was a kid, so I'm familiar enough with the game, and I have enough knowledge secondhand of what's going on. But explain to me the replay system they instituted this year.
Explain. Okay. Well, only certain plays are actually covered under it. So there are some plays which really should be covered that are not. One is called the neighborhood play, where at second base, a runner that's running into second base, he doesn't necessarily, like, the second baseman doesn't necessarily have to have his foot on second base to tag the runner out. If he has the ball in the glove and he's standing kind of near second base.
So in the neighborhood of second base?
In the neighborhood, absolutely. So then this player can be called, or the runner can be called out if he's there with the ball before the runner is. So, but that play's not reviewable, which is ridiculous to me because, I mean, it's obvious that this is like traveling in basketball. I don't know if you watch a little more basketball, but they never call traveling. And they really should, because these guys travel all the time. But maybe they're thinking, okay, this would slow down the game even more. And that's kind of what this replay thing has done. It's just, it's made these games unwatchable. I know you're a New Yorker. I don't know if you're a Yankee fan or a Met fan. But anytime I watch the Yankees play, especially against the Red Sox, it's like a 4.5 hour thing. I've got to have, like, multiple beverages lined up. I've got to have snacks in place.
A blanket.
Yeah, blanket in case things get cold. You know, I've got to have the cell phone next to me in case there's an emergency, because otherwise I'll just fall into a coma. I can't watch it. So I'm a National League fan. I like to see a little quicker paced game. I like to see the pitchers make fools of themselves and hit.
Is that a stereotype, or is that true that National League play is a little bit faster and more intense?
I think it's a little bit faster. I think it always sort of has been because, well, for a long time, the National League was sort of the pitcher's league. I don't know if this is really the case anymore. There's a little more parity. But the pitchers, since they batted, right? So you've got a pitcher going up there and probably striking out 3 times a game, which even just with that, it speeds things up a little bit because you have a few less rallies, maybe a few less runs scored because you don't have a ninth decent bat in the lineup. So that's part of it. And I don't know. I'm a huge Chicago Cubs fan. And so they're terrible, and they have been forever.
I totally empathize with you.
Mm.
I am a diehard Buffalo Bills fan.
We have not
been back to the playoffs since Clinton was in office.
Oh, yeah. You guys have had it really rough. Really, really rough. And I know, I mean, I don't know if you're a Chris Berman fan. I'm not really.
Yeah.
But every time I see Chris Berman on TV, he's talking about the Bills. He somehow gets them into the conversation.
He and Chuck Klosterman as well, but yeah. Klosterman graduated from Binghamton University.
Okay.
So he's an upstate boy as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Berman does try to wedge them in everything. But to give you an idea of how bad we are, you know, last year, right now it's training camp,
right,
and training camp's about to break. The
right.
Hall of Fame game is this weekend, the Buffalo mm-hmm. Bills versus the Giants. I will have my jersey pressed, and I will watch us lose.
Awesome. Okay, that's true fandom right there.
It is indeed. Last year, though, at the end of the training camp, one of our quarterbacks, who was going to become the second quarterback, second string.
Second stringer, yeah.
Breaks his foot and ankle walking from the practice field on the rubber mats.
Oh, yeah.
And all I could do is just sit there reading the news report going, seriously, I can't name any of my fiction writing friends who can come up with this kind of stuff. This is, oh, Buffalo. And that's all I could just say was just, oh, Buffalo.
Oh, yeah.
I've given up on you, and the season hasn't even, the training camp hasn't even broken yet, and I'm already depressed.
Isn't just that the thing with these last place teams? I mean, what happens with the Cubs is whenever they sign a free agent and make a big splash, as soon as he comes here, he either has the worst slump of his life, or he hurts himself terribly in an injury that his career never can recover from. It's just, it's unbelievable how, like clockwork, anybody that comes in is just decimated.
Have the Cubbies had any good players since Ryan Sandberg?
Yeah, they've had a few. I mean, Greg Maddux stuck around a little longer than Sandberg, although he's part of that era, just went into the Hall of Fame this weekend, my personal favorite player. You know, you can talk a little bit about that Sammy Sosa, Mark Grace era.
Yeah.
Mark Grace, so funny. He was arrested for DUI again recently, and he's living in Arizona in a prison camp where the sheriff has given all the prisoners a tent outside in the desert. And so Mark Grace is somewhere in the desert in a prison tent.
Well, then.
Which is pretty, pretty amazing fall from grace from the night I was there for his 3,000th hit.
It's kind of like the Pete Maravich story, the Superboy. You know, in the 80s, they grew this kid basically as a, you know, they called him the test tube.
Yeah, the
quarterback.
Freak, right.
And, you know, they watch him go up. He's trained from like 6 weeks old to be starting quarterback one day. And he gets up there, and because he was denied a life of pleasure in many ways, he just goes ballistic when he gets to college and implodes when he gets to the NFL.
Those are like those kids who had granola for dessert, you know, and then they go to school or something and they realize, oh, my God, cotton candy is a thing. You know,
wow, sugar exists.
Stuff in their face with it.
You know, bring a Simpsons reference into it. Don't worry, there's no sugar in Pixie Six.
My husband would love that. He's a huge Simpsons fan. So
I gave up on them around season 10.
Okay.
I am one of those curmudgeon-y sons of bitches who says, basically, seasons 3 through 10. After that, I don't pay a damn attention to them.
Right. No, that, and that's the thing you kind of have to do, because at a certain point, I mean, and maybe this goes back to the baseball thing. I have a friend that did this with the Cubs, which, I mean, it's sacrilege, but she was just like, I'm moving to Los Angeles now. I'm not going to follow it anymore. I mean, it's just too hard. It's too painful. It's too much of a commitment.
At least the Dodgers occasionally do something to make you happy.
Oh, and they are winning right now. They're leading their division. They look good. I mean, obviously, they've paid through the nose for the team. But
And they rehired Vin Scully.
Right. And Vin, I mean, talk about having some fun. Talk about someone you'd want to have on the SAFTAcast. That man can tell a yarn. Shit.
Oh, he would be, I'd never get him because, you know, he probably wouldn't, you know, he'd be like, what are you talking about? But, you know, he's one of those sportscasters I do enjoy listening to. Bob Uecker was always great to listen to.
Yes.
Because he would just ramble, and there's that great clip online of him trying to figure out what furries are when a fur convention comes into Milwaukee.
Oh, yeah, furries.
And
okay.
He tries to figure out what's going on, and for like 10 minutes, he's just sitting there rambling about it. In between going, and the pitch, and ball three. So these people, they dress up in costumes then. And it's hilarious. And that's, you know, people dump on baseball for being slow and for being boring. But really, to me, the great joy is splicing out all the actual game footage and just listening to the commentators ramble.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. And Bob Uecker, actually, all that footage that he did for Major League, it's all improv.
Doesn't surprise me one bit.
I mean, they gave him a script, but the director, I think, told him, look, do whatever you want. You're Bob Uecker. You're the guy we wanted. And he didn't even read it. I don't think he even read it. That's the story I was told, at least. And I mean, comic gold.
He knew what he was doing. I mean, he does it for a living. So it's like, look, yeah, I can do this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let me do what I do.
Yeah. You
know? That's why he wanted me. I'll do it then.
Don't come at me with this script.
Yeah. I'm Bob Uecker. I do this for, you know, I do this 160 times a year. I know what I'm doing here. I have to find a way to fill 3 hours of conversation with somebody. I got it.
Absolutely.
Don't worry about it. So, okay, the Cubbies are not doing well.
No.
As always. Mm-hmm. But like a couple years ago, I seem to remember them.
Yeah.
People were like, what? The Cubbies might make the playoffs.
Yeah, 2007 and 2008 were pretty good to us. 2007, I think, I mean, I'm going to sound stupid here if I get this wrong, but there was one of those years we won like 95 games. I mean, we were flying high.
Hey, we're over 500.
Yeah, we were way over 500. I mean, people, every time I turned on the game, I would rub my eyes. I couldn't believe it. But I think there was a lot going on here that was just, it was not sustainable. There were a lot of big contracts and older veterans and not a lot of good players in the farm system. And in 2008, we had a big problem where the team just sort of collapsed in the middle of the year. They were looking really good out of the gates. They actually ended up sneaking into the playoffs, but it just, you could tell that it was a one-shot deal, and when it was over, it was over. So now we're in this big rebuilding process thing. So Chicago has now turned into Kansas City. I guess, where people are not supposed to care, except this is a big market, and we are a little bit like New Yorkers in that we don't have tons of patience, and so it's been 4 or 5 years, and we're kind of wondering, when are you going to stop selling off all of our talent?
When are you actually going to rebuild?
Yeah, so we're kind of still in that rebuilding phase, but it's been kind of fun to watch this year. There have been a couple guys in the minor leagues that I'm excited about, and I'm kind of that nerd. Wow, here I go. No, okay, I'm identifying as a nerd now, so that's good.
Told you.
Yeah, you're right. You asked the right questions here.
I'm okay with that because it's very rare. I don't think we've had it so far on the Saftacast where we've had someone who's knowledgeable about sport. Openly knowledgeable about sport. I mean, maybe some people are. It just never came up. But I'm always fascinated with intellectuals who love sport.
Yeah, I think sport is a great metaphor. I mean, you hear that all the time. Everybody knows it to be true. But I mean, especially with baseball, but with other sports too. I love watching tennis. My husband was a nationally ranked amateur tennis player in Australia. And golf too. They're all great metaphors. There's just so much there to mine. So as a writer too, and especially as a person who's been a diehard fan of some of these teams since I was a kid, there's so many angles to kind of examine to say, you know, how does this relate to other things we do? What kind of social commentary does this provide?
Yeah, I mean, Buffalo provides me with a constant litany of disappointment and depression.
Right, which is a great way to acculturate you to certain other things in your life. At least that's the way I think about it sometimes pessimistically, you know, where, okay, like if I came up with a culture of losing in sports, maybe it doesn't surprise me so much that I have to send out hundreds of submissions to get a few things published, you know.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. It doesn't hurt so bad. You figure, okay, I'm really going to cherish it when it really happens finally, this championship or whatever.
Or you go into a fatalist tailspin of just nothing really matters.
Nothing really matters. I'm never going to get what I want. And until the day I die, I'll be waiting for it.
You know, I long for the sweet embrace of death, for I will find peace.
Right. I mean, I think that's where my father's at, really. And he's not even anywhere close to death. But he's in his 60s, and he hasn't seen a championship. And it's just getting to the point where we go to the game, and he opens the conversation with bitterness. It used to be that the bitterness would come in around the third or fourth inning. Now it's just, you know, we get in the car, and he's bitter, you know?
Why are we even doing this?
Right. No, that happened like 2 games ago. He was like, it took us 2 fucking hours to get down here. We're sitting in traffic. This bus driver is sweating and it's wafting over me. Why am I even here right now? You know, so.
That's when you gently take his hand and go, I'm your daughter. You're my father.
Right.
That's why you're here.
We're having some bonding time right now.
Exactly. You know?
Right. So.
But no, I totally understand as a Bills fan. Every year I try to come up with more jokes about how we're going to fail.
Yes.
And surprisingly, over the last 2 years, like every year I tried to make a joke about how bad we are at the draft.
Right.
Like 2 years ago or 3 years ago, I made the joke that we drafted one of the Radio City Music Hall staff on accident. And then a couple years ago, the draft was the same weekend as the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction, so I made the public joke that we accidentally drafted Usher thinking he was a football player and not realizing that we were at the Staples Center. But the last 2 years, I'm sitting there watching the draft, and they pick up E.J. Manuel from Florida State, mm-hmm. and then this year they pick up a wideout, Sammy out of, I forget, school offhand, and I'm sitting there going, did you actually just do something good?
Right. Throws you completely off guard.
Well, there was about 5 years ago, the Bills went 8-0 or something like that. They were like 6-0, 7-0. They were doing great. And I'm sitting there going, what is this? And then they started losing immediately. And I just went, now we understand. Now we can crawl inside the whiskey bottle because now we understand what this means.
And you're expecting it. That's the thing. Whenever anything good happens, there's, you know, you feel like out of your comfort zone, you're jolted. It's very uncomfortable out there. And as soon as the losing begins, you're like, I understand this. I know what's happening now.
Well, the Giants imploded last year.
Mm-hmm.
And that was upsetting for friends of mine who are diehard Giants fans from New York.
Sure.
And I joked with them. I said, you think you've got it bad? And I showed the clip that CBS showed of a fan falling off the building at Ralph Wilson Stadium in Buffalo. And I'm like, we're trying to kill ourselves so the season is over faster for us.
And I think the Giants were in contention for a good part. Like, they were around 500 for a while.
No, they just, they bombed right at the beginning. Oh, were okay. Out. They were out. It was like sitting there watching a train wreck for a while.
Okay. I probably was not paying attention as
that's,
well. As
that's okay, though. You know, we've got our sports.
Yes. You know? No, that's true. But, I mean, let me ask you a question, though.
Okay.
Regarding the jokes. If someone else who's not a fan of your team makes any sort of joke about your team losing, it's just not the same. It's like they... Do you feel like someone really has to prove something to you before they can also make one of those bitter jokes?
No, I just piggyback it immediately and try and top them. It becomes a game of one-upmanship to create the worst, you know, the race to the bottom.
Because I just feel like I get very defensive at that point, you know, and I tell people, well, you haven't proved your credentials to me that you can make that joke at this point.
So if I were to make a Cubs joke,
I would just get angry, probably.
What if I quoted the one from Ferris Bueller? What's the score? Nothing. Who's winning? The Bears.
All right. Now, that's okay. That's okay. I don't really have a problem with that.
It's the only Cubs joke I have.
No, that's fine. I don't have a problem with that joke because it's not spewing the type of haterade that I particularly, you know, dislike. I think the funny thing about the Bears in this town, everybody says that they're a Bears fan. Everybody purports to be a Bears fan. It's one of the teams that brings the city together. The thing is, and I'll tell you, I mean, I love the Bears too. I watch the Bears. No problem with it. But if the Cubs won the World Series, it'd be like Bears who? I hate to say it because we know football is bringing in more revenue and more fans than any other sport.
But we're talking about the Cubs.
Yeah, right. We're talking about 100-plus years at this point. So,
yeah, I mean, look what happened to Boston when they won their first, you know, 86 years. They broke the streak.
Right.
And look what happened to Boston. They just exploded.
Oh, yeah.
Suddenly, it didn't matter that the Patriots were going for their fourth Super Bowl. It didn't matter anymore.
No, it's like Tom Brady who? Not really. But
exactly. It was like, you know, all hail the crazy guy on the Boston squad at the time. I can't remember his name now.
David Ortiz. He's still there being crazy.
He amuses me. We need more silly players like that again.
No, I agree with that.
That's something we lost.
My husband, whenever he watches baseball, he's not a big baseball fan, but he watches David Ortiz with the same amusement I think you do. He's like, did that guy really just like take down that entire bat rack? Was that a real thing? And I'm like, yeah, I think he does that once a week.
We need more players like, this is reaching into the annals of baseball a little bit. We need players like Bill Lee again.
Yeah.
Who are just complete goofballs. Yeah. And you're not really sure if they're sane or not, but then they get up and you're like, okay, you're a decent player.
Right, and I love that when you see that in players that where you didn't expect it. Like, there's the time when Greg Maddux went all slip and slide on the rain tarp at Wrigley Field.
Yeah.
And you think of him, he's the professor, right? He's clinical, he's got it all figured out, super intellectual, and then he's like, hey, let's go slip and slide, you know? It's just sort of fun.
We need more players like that.
Yeah, really absolutely. Do. Because I hate it. I mean, of course, this is the fan in me, and I'm sure you feel this way too. When they're always talking about the sport as their job, you know, and doing their business, it's just so dry. I wish somebody would say, I love this. I get to do this all the time. I can't fucking believe they're paying me $100 million to do this. You know, I just, for once, you know.
Yeah, I think the last one I remember in football doing that would be Brett Favre, but I have my issues with him.
Right, and then he got in trouble for all the reasons.
Oh,
so.
Yeah, and then there were reports of him just last month talking, they're like, will Brett Favre come back to the Packers this year?
Oh my God, yes. It seems like every preseason there's some sort of Brett Favre rumor. Probably until he is 50 years old, you will hear this.
I'm guessing when he's 70.
Yeah.
Will Brett Favre return to the commentary box this year?
Right.
Or will he stay at home?
It always seems to be in the NFC North, too. Like, whatever team it is, it's like, it's probably going to be in the NFC North.
Probably. You sure as hell ain't going to come to Buffalo.
No, I don't know. I mean, that's kind of the lure, I think, of these really special players. At least we've tried to do that here. It doesn't really work. But to say, don't you want to come here and turn the tide? Isn't this the place you want to come? We've lost. Don't you want to be the hero? It doesn't really work here, though.
So what brings players to Chicago, then?
I don't know, the tiny clubhouses and the crumbling bricks. No, it's not that.
Is it the history? You know, wow, I'm in Wrigley.
Right now, we're just drafting young players and kind of, you know, keeping them on those 7-year leashes. And I think that's what's I think those are the only players who are coming here willingly at this point. Although
I wonder if the Cubs could just like scout people who know nothing about baseball, like some from some foreign land far away, and just be like, you want to play professional baseball in the United States? Yeah. And then they come to America and they're like, oh shit, I'm a member of the Cubs now. Too late. Ha ha. We got you.
Yeah, we've got you. Ah. I read this book called The Eastern Stars, and I can't remember the author's name, but he's a memoirist and an essayist of pretty well-known stature. And he wrote this book basically about how baseball players in the Dominican Republic get signed by these major league teams. And it's basically what you just described. A lot of them are working in industries down there, and these scouts find them. They're just sort of athletic guys. Some of them aren't even playing baseball. And they just say, hey, would you like to, you know, make some money and get signed to this minor league contract? And these guys, the scouts just kind of teach them how to play, sort of, well enough. They say they're athletic. And then they ship them off to the U.S. if they can play well enough. But a lot of them didn't, I don't think they dreamed to become baseball stars. You know, they live in this third world country and, you know, they kind of like to be active and outdoors and playing sports. And the scouts just sort of say, hey, do you want to do this? Hmm. And they sort of get into it without knowing much about it at all.
There's a good documentary I saw a couple of maybe last year or something, Pelotero, which is a John Leguizamo, I think, is a producer or whatever.
Okay.
And it focuses on two pitchers in the Dominican Republic growing up and how the draft works for them down there.
Okay.
You know, how they go through the process of you're 15. Well, we are scouting you now.
Right.
And it's fascinating to watch how these you know, I don't want to say third world, second world, because I don't know those terms, what they really mean, but to see impoverished young men and they've got the dreams of $100 million contracts and to watch the process and the bidding war that happens on a 15-year-old who they think, give them 5 years, they're going to kill everybody in the NL.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And a lot of these players will say, well, I know I'm not really good enough to be a major league player, but if I can work in the U.S. for a few years and save some money, whatever, I'm going to take that chance. You
know? Yeah. See, I've always enjoyed minor league baseball.
Yes.
That to me is a lot more fun. It's one, it's cheaper.
Yes. And they have those dollar beer nights. How can you pass that?
You can't argue with that. $20 will get you a night's entertainment.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And then a lot of free prizes.
Yeah, the goofy promotions that happen. Like, all right, end of the third. All right, we're going to take off a bunch of kids' shoes, throw them in this pit, and all right, first one to find their shoes and bring it back to the mascot gets the prize.
Right.
And now it's time for the wacky mascot race around the backtrack.
Right. What I love about the minor league games is kind of trying to scout out the best free stuff, because they're giving so much of it away. It's kind of like one of those festivals that you'll go to in your hometown where there's like Comcast is there and like the railroad is there and they're trying to give away free cups and stuff. So the last minor league game I was at, I got, I think, a frisbee, a t-shirt, a coupon for barbecue sauce. And at that point you feel like you've won, you know, whatever you paid for the ticket or the parking or whatever, you've made back in coupons and cheap plastic crap.
Yeah.
So you feel like you're going home satisfied. Plus, you got to see the game, which may or may not have been interesting, you know. So there's that, too.
And you usually have very good seats.
Yes.
And if you don't have good seats, usually you can just wander over to another section, find a spot, and sit there.
Right. And you can sit next to the church group of toddlers mm-hmm. who have peanut allergies. And you can kind of see what they're doing.
Yep. And then wander around and get to know people. It's fun.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So the minor league games are pretty fun. There's a minor league park that's about as close to where I live as Wrigley Field. So we go to Wrigley and see games. I probably see 15 to 20 games a summer there. And then if we want some cheap entertainment, we'll go out to see the Kane County Cougars, which are about 45 minutes in the other direction. And it's fun because you kind of get to play scout if you're a big baseball fan. So you wear your glasses, you wear your hat, you get your notepad out, you know, and you start writing down things that are incomprehensible to anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And you stand there next to the radar gun guy and talk to him a little bit.
And they think you're awesome and all that, yeah.
Well, or they think because you're a woman, you have to like prove yourself to them, or that you don't really know anything, you know. So that's always fun when you feel like you have to kind of reel off a bunch of stats just to make somebody feel like you're legitimate.
You got to prove your credentials. It's the same in all geek culture. You got to prove who you are.
I hope it doesn't have anything to do with gender. I want to believe it's not. You know,
it does. And that's the problem, especially in geek culture as well. Uh-huh. If you are a girl geek or a girl nerd, you come in and say, you know, oh, I really enjoy Star Trek. Men have this attitude of suddenly, well, you don't understand. You don't really know Star Trek because you don't know about, you know, whatever. And I hate this pissing contest. The thing is, it is gender-based, but it's also not, because guys do it to other guys, too.
Yeah, right.
And there has to be this pissing contest of who is the uber nerd here. And right. I just say, hey, can't we just accept, okay, maybe I don't know this as well as you, but I still like it. You like
it. Right.
What do you like about it? Because I probably like the same things.
Right, absolutely. And I see that a lot in poetry culture too. You know, I mean, we're not supposed to talk about that too much, but really I see that so much, where we are really condescending or we're exclusionary to someone who's doing something that maybe isn't trendy or
James Franco
doesn't make sense, or is trying, we assume that they're trying too hard or something.
Or they don't belong.
Right. Because we are the tastemakers or something. But honestly, in poetry, I mean, and some of these other cultures too, right? We need all the people we can get. I mean, True. We should just be like thanking these people for reading, buying the books, you know, being there, coming with a smile on their face.
Why don't we just hug James Franco and say, look, you've got poetry in the mainstream again. People are talking about it.
Right. I mean, I think that's what Margaret Bashar wants to do, right? She just wants to hug James Franco and say, it's going to be okay, I promise.
I don't want to bash him for his literary merits or anything. I want to bash him for his acting and such and be like, come on, man. He is trying too hard as an artist. It's like, you don't need to do this.
James Franco reminds me of kind of the overeager undergraduate, maybe the type of undergraduate I wish I had more so in my classes, who just wants to do a little bit of everything and really believes that he can do almost anything. You know, like, I can be an artist. I can sit inside of a glass box for 3 days and let people watch me. You know, I can write these poems. I can do this screenwriting thing. And it's cool, but it's kind of that perpetual undergraduate or community college student. I have a couple friends who are still doing this. They're about 30, still in community college, kind of just taking classes, trying to figure out what they're going to do. They may never choose a side, and maybe that's okay, you know, but he just kind of reminds me of that person.
Yeah, it reeks of effort.
Yeah.
Is what it does. It reeks of effort for me. You know, just, you know, it's cool that you want to try different things.
Sure.
But you are not Sammy Davis Jr.
Sure.
You are not capable of being Sammy and be able to tell jokes, dance, sing, and, you know, tell a story all at the same time.
You're not that cool, man.
You are not Sammy, you know? Because no. He's the bar I set, really, yeah. Sammy Davis Jr. He is the consummate entertainer.
Oh, yeah.
He and Johnny Carson, I think, are right. Yeah. Yeah, that's the level you have to hit if you want to say, I can do anything.
Well, Sammy Davis Jr., the time he really hit his cool factor for me, and what I'll remember, out of all the things I've seen of his, he made driving a garbage truck look cool in Ocean's 11.
I was going to say,
EO11. I mean, how do you do that? Driving a garbage truck does not seem that cool.
And then singing. Singing about driving a garbage truck and wanting a limousine to your garbage truck crew members around a fire bin that, you know, oil drum on fire. And he makes it sound like it's the greatest thing on earth for you.
Yeah, I mean, don't start a smooth contest because you are going to lose.
Yeah.
With him.
The only one he could lose to would be Frank.
Yeah. Right, and that's kind of the unfortunate thing, isn't it? Where, like, you're going to play second fiddle or third fiddle, and it's just because of your era. It's just because of your friends, mm-hmm. you know? It's not inherently has anything to do with you.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tragic.
Well, yeah, it is. It is. We need more goofy people in poetry, I think, too.
Yeah, I think that's true. I wish I could tell jokes in my poems. I'm really bad at that. I think my poems are too serious at times because I love telling jokes, and I think part of the strong suit, like you and Corinna were talking about poet voice, and one of the strong suits of my readings is I like to make a lot of jokes. I feel like I need to make the jokes between the poems because the poems are so contemplative, you know. Maybe they're doing a James Franco thing where they're trying too hard, I don't know. But in the middle, I try to make these jokes to hopefully to add some levity. But I would love to be goofier inside the poems, you know.
I think you have to be wary of that. Humor is so difficult to do
yeah.
in any form. And if you try doing it, it's sometimes, like students do this, undergrad students especially. All I look at them, and I tell this especially to undergrad writers who are doing their essays and everything, I look at them, I'm like, you're being clever. And I think immediately my brain just goes right to Tyler Durden. Oh, that's clever. How's that working out for you? Being clever, I mean.
All right. In my AP European history class in high school, I remember, I thought I was definitely hot shit. So in these classes in high school, I remember in my essays having like, oh, I don't know, maybe 10 parenthetical references a page where I was inserting my own opinion in a very snarky manner after every historical event I was detailing in my history essay. Mm-hmm. And I look back at that now, and I just feel bad for these teachers. I feel terrible for them. I can't believe they put up with that.
I really wish I could remember the people I had in my first 2 years of college so I could send them apology notes.
Oh, yeah. Because you totally would at this point. I mean, I would.
Oh, I would. You know, having gotten a PhD and everything, yeah, I'd send them letters and be like, I tried to make something of myself, right. but I am still feeling shame.
And, you know, they would probably be proud of you. This is the way I reconcile it for myself, and I have to do this because otherwise I'll just feel guilty. But I usually think to myself, you know what? In some weird way, I probably brightened up their grading night because there's this stack of incredibly dull essays. And then there's this one essay that's trying way too hard and is over the top and slightly annoying, but you can tell that there's something back there. There's something going on in their brain, even if it's just a glitch that's malfunctioning. But there's...
And it brings you a moment of amusement.
Right! There's at least that, you know?
I've started keeping a file of the most amazing student sentences and comments I have ever read. And I'm not showing it to anyone. It's just for my own private amusement, basically. But I have to write them down or else I'll forget them and be like, wow.
Now you have to tell me one of them.
Okay, I'll tell you one that I've told this one publicly to students, so I don't feel bad about it.
Okay, you can change the names. It's not...
Oh, there's nothing to be changed. The student was writing about it was supposed to be an essay about formative moments in their life.
Okay.
And a student wrote about the first time they saw a motorcycle.
Okay.
And it brought them down the road that they now own like two or three motorcycles or whatever, and they you know, lifelong rider and everything. But they're writing the story about how they're sitting outside one night when they're a young teen, and it's a hot Florida night, or hot Southern night, I forget, because I've taught in the South all over. So let's just say the South. I have no idea.
Right,
where.
Okay.
And they're sitting out there, and they hear this most amazing sound. And I forget how they described it. They said the motorcycle comes around the corner, and this was the line that just struck me. I quote, "It was motorcycle." They dropped the antecedent, and I fell out of my chair loving it. And so now it has become a little bit of a meme around the house with my wife and I and a couple friends that if we are ever surprised or shocked by something, we just go, "It was motorcycle."
It was motorcycle. It was God.
The Cubs are going to the wild card series. It was motorcycle.
Motorcycle. Yes.
It was motorcycle that did that. Motorcycle. Maybe that's what they need.
And that is maybe the purest form of awe, where you've stopped even being able to use your linguistic skills, however high or low they are, and you can't even remember to put the article in there.
Yeah, you just go with it. And I don't know if it was just a, I'm assuming it was just a typographical error. But it was so amazing to me, that great change in language.
Right, absolutely.
That it became one of those little things, you know?
Yeah. Well, and you've got to have those. I mean, my husband and I now, we have a saying around the house. We've both been kind of going on a lot of job interviews, for better or for worse. And so whenever he leaves the house, and I don't even know how this got started, but we started saying, don't say panties on the job interview. Like, so instead of saying break a leg, as soon as he leaves the house, it's like, don't say panties. And I don't...
So what can you offer this company? Panties? Oh,
right.
Shit, no.
Right. Shit! Mm. Yes, exactly.
Where do you see yourself in 5 years with this company? Panties? I mean... And what would you, you know, what do you think a good salary would be for this position? About 30,000 panties?
Pennies, right.
I mean, pennies. I mean, no, wait.
But if you think about just some of the worst things you could say on the job interview, other than just horrific swearing, I guess.
I could think of a few, you know, yeah. I slept with your wife. Hitler was right.
Oh, yes. You're right. You're right. You're right. That's true.
You know, thank God for Saddam Hussein.
Oh boy, yeah.
That's a Conan O'Brien joke. I can't take credit for that last one.
Yeah, no, that's good. You probably shouldn't take credit for it if you can at all possibly move it away from yourself.
Well, so, not only that, it's a good routine, and I want to give credit where credit is due.
It is good, and I appreciate that for sure.
At least the Saddam Hussein line. That's from one of the satellite news channel bits.
Yeah.
And it was the inappropriate channel. Because every time somebody would do that, it was a father and son, and the son comes up and the father says, thank God for Saddam Hussein, or something like that, and then just it splashes on the screen, inappropriate.
And that just sounds exactly like what you would hear on one of those channels. Because it's gotten to the point with the cable news where every time you flick it on, they have to say something that sounds engaging or terrible or important or ridiculous in order to just keep you on the station. Like, the last time I really watched CNN in a bold, aggressive way was during the last presidential election. And just every single moment, I felt like they had to either recap the story or say the same headline in a different way. And that's just what broke me of the cable news. I just cannot handle it anymore. I mean, I've really gotten back to the old school method of either I pick up a newspaper once a week, or I just try not to pay attention to a lot of things unless they're really important, because it's just too much. It frays your nerves, you know?
No, I can see that. But you get, at the same time, you can get some amazing stuff out of that, too.
That's true. That's true. And if it's fodder for material for you, like you were telling me, or telling Corinna, I don't even remember, but about kind of the improv thing, right, that you used to do. So, of course, for something like that, or for Conan, he needs that stuff. I mean, but what's great about it is, he maybe is thinking about it from a different angle, right? He's taking a different slant on it. I guess for me, the more I watch, the more depressed I get. But for him, he can watch it and say, okay, what am I going to make out of this? You know?
For me, it's entertainment. I'll watch, I love local news because I'm watching for the screw-ups.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's what I'm watching, and that's why I watch some reality televisions. And I'm looking for, did I see the boom mic in that shot? That's what I'm watching for, because I like the breaking of it. I've always been a person who loves the fourth wall break.
Yes.
And when it's done well, I love a good fourth wall break.
And I'm big on that, especially with classic television, because I noticed in classic television, they were a lot less stringent about hiding that stuff if you really watch. So like in the Bob Newhart show, you can see where the set ends, or the set, you know, the set ends, and then like some concrete begins basically from inside the studio in his office. Or on the Mary Tyler Moore show, sometimes you can see the mic kind of bobbling up at the top of the shot on the ceiling, you know.
What about where it's intentional, like the Gary Shandling show was complete fourth wall break, the entire thing. It was
right.
They talked about it. It's like, we are in a television studio.
Right.
And, you know, for example, a simple joke was that they go on a flight one time and they get to the airport. Then you see a toy plane float across the screen, across the camera lens. Then they walk into the set from a different angle and Gary goes, wow, this airport looks really familiar. Like the one we just left.
No, that stuff is good. Or on Saved by the Bell, where, you know, Zach freezes the frame and talks to the audience. I remember, you know, even as a child, I think I was thinking, that's so meta, you know.
I think one of the best, the John Larroquette show did it as well, occasionally. Like, there's one scene, if I recall right, they're in a subway station and a tumbleweed blows by. And it's a subtle thing, but it works beautifully.
Right.
The problem with Fourth Wall is that most audiences hate it. They can't handle it.
And those are the same people who don't like movies with those gray area endings. You know, they just want that happy ending at the end of the movie. They can't handle something where you realize by the end, not everything's sewn up. I love going to see movies with these people because what ends up happening is I just say to them, but don't you want your entertainment in some ways to mirror your reality? Don't you want to see something that in some ways portrays parts of your life? And they're like, no, I really don't. I don't want to see. And they're willfully telling you they want to be in suspension, right? They want to be lied to, right? And I just, I don't know. I never felt that way. I like to see someone broken down and making sort of bitter jokes about that, you know, but maybe that's just me.
Once in a while, I do enjoy the fantasy. Right. I want to escape.
Yes.
But I understand what you mean.
And I think that's part of growing up is realizing that sometimes you have to have that and you should embrace it. Going back to like that overeager undergrad who's kind of like, no, everything needs to be dark and serious. You know, I think when you get older, you realize I do need that fluff. I've got to have it. So I watch a lot of classic TV because everything in classic TV is pretty much sewn up for you, you know.
And so if I were to go on to that realm, then what are some of your favorite classic TV? When you say classic TV, are we talking 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s? What are we talking here?
Oh, we're talking all of it, Scott.
Okay. So give me a few. What are some of the ones that you love dearly?
Okay, well, we'll go by decade then, just to preview.
Right.
So,
bring it.
Of course, like, there's your I Love Lucy for the 50s. For the 60s, the Dick Van Dyke Show. For the 70s, we've got a ton of heavy hitters in the 70s. I'm a big Rockford Files fan, Bob Newhart, Mary Tyler Moore, like I mentioned. 80s, Magnum P.I., Golden Girls, I guess that was at the end of that decade, early 90s.
Mid to late 80s.
Yeah, I guess it started then. 90s, and I consider 90s shows classic TV at this point. Maybe I shouldn't. But like Frasier, Full House, I can kind of watch them all, and it's for different reasons. Like when I watch the Dick Van Dyke Show or the Rockford Files, I'm like in awe. I think the shows are so well done. And then when I watch like Full House, it's more just for entertainment purposes and to kind of laugh at it. You know, and look at people's weird clothing and hairdos. So, but it's all kind of for different, there's a stratified set of reasons why I watch it. But it's kind of, it's comforting, right? You've seen it all before, you know how it's going to end. And then also you sort of get to drop yourself into this alternate reality that doesn't exist anymore. And you can kind of say, what would it be like if I was living in the 70s or something? Would I have that, I don't know, Thunderbird. Would I have those bell bottoms? Would I live next to Mary? You know?
So. Fair enough. No, I understand where you're coming from on that. I just can't watch sitcoms anymore, even old ones.
I can't watch anything new. I was down in Knoxville with TA and Aaron and Sarah Einstein, and they are brilliant. And especially, and Aaron and Sarah were talking about all these new TV shows, and I'm like, oh, I can't even fathom it. Like keeping up with something new is difficult. Watching any, I mean, just, it's just so overwhelming for me at this point.
I like some current TV, but I can't stand sitcoms anymore. My tolerance for them died. Even classic sitcoms, I can't handle it anymore.
Well, they're so manufactured. And so for a lot of people, they just can't handle that because it just, there's no semblance of reality, right? It's just way too nice and neat and they're too short. And a lot of times the endings wrap up and then there's not a lot of story continuation.
There's only one that I can deal with.
What's that?
Cheers.
Oh, yes.
For the simple fact, and I think the reason why it holds up, is that if you take the classic Roman Commedia dell'arte and put it over on Cheers, you find that the Cheers is the Commedia 600 years later.
Right, and I can definitely see that. I mean, all the elements are sort of there.
The archetypes of the Commedia are right there.
I think the best of entertainment is when you can kind of see that, and you can see that they are not actually, they're not trying to reinvent a wheel, but what they're doing is the writing is just sharp enough. And that's the thing, too. The things I really love, I watch for the writing. Like, the movie that I love so much, bringing it back to baseball, is Bull Durham. Right. In Bull Durham, you have these amazing monologues. All the characters have them. And they're like straight out of classic drama, you know, and you're just like, this character has won me over with 1 3-minute monologue or soliloquy about why they love this or their philosophy on life or whatever, you know, and they're talking about something that is totally modern. Right, in this really modern setting, minor league baseball or a bar or whatever, but they're doing enough to make it new, but they're relying on those kind of classic tropes.
So is Bull Durham the quintessential baseball movie?
It might be. I think it's one of the best made baseball movies. There are others that are funnier and easier to watch, you know, but I love Bull Durham because there's so much depth there. I mean, basically, you've got Emily Dickinson, Walt Whitman, baseball, and a lot of sex, all wrapped up in one, all wrapped up in one movie.
And Costner when he's at his best.
Yes, right. And I mean, and you can see in the Annie Savoy character, someone who's just really kind of always been searching, right? Someone who's so wise, but yet at the other side of things is just really not knowing what she's doing. And she's an adjunct at a community college, which mirrors my life in some ways, right? But she has
a human job, basically.
Yeah, she has a real job, and she has a crappy house with some cats, and she's trying to spice it up every year by sleeping with a new baseball player. And then, you know, Kevin Costner comes in and he's like, you're afraid because this might be the real thing that might mess up your entire routine, your shtick, right? And so there's a lot of that reality in there. But then at the same time, there's this magical element that's so outside of our everyday. I think it's definitely one of the best, smartest baseball movies.
What is the quintessential baseball film, though? Is there one?
I don't know. I mean, a lot of them show different sides of the game. It's hard to kind of capture it all because there's so many different metaphors here. As we were talking about before, there's so many different ways to talk about it. Like, you can look at a movie like Major League and say that captures so much of the humor, right? Or just the ridiculousness of what people kind of go through for their teams. Or you can look at, I don't know, For the Love of the Game, and you can say, but that's kind of dramatic. It's kind of over dramatic. Or The Natural. It's hard to say that one is the one. I don't know if there's one that encapsulates it all. I like Bull Durham because it comes at it from the minor league angle, which is probably the closest to truly talking about baseball without all the other statistics and the money and everything that comes with the show, the major leagues.
Yeah, I was just about to say, Moneyball focuses on the current business side of it a lot more.
Which is great. Moneyball is amazing. And my favorite scene in Moneyball, though, harkens back to all this purity stuff, where Brad Pitt is laying in the outfield, just like feeling the grass under his palms near the end of the movie. And you just see the humanity of that. I mean, this is a man who, you know, Billy Bean, the character that he plays, is a real guy who's the real GM of the Oakland Athletics, general manager. And he's invested his entire life in this trajectory, and it's already gone off track multiple times with not being the player he thought he could be. But yet he can't get out of it. And this is how these players and coaches and managers are too. It's like, or even Brett Favre, you could look at Brett Favre, right? This is a guy who can't stop coming back to the park every day. There's something in him that won't let him stay away from
America rolls on, and baseball has kept the times.
Right. Yeah. There are a million great quotes about it. I mean, Whitman says it's America's game, you know. So there's just something magical about it. I mean, I guess I should say after all of this I'll just put this one thing in here about writing, which is that right now I am writing a book of poems about Wrigley Field. So this stuff has been very much on my mind, the sentimentality. You know, there's a part in a poem that I'm writing right now where my father's a character, and the line is something like, my father gripes and wipes his nose during an April game where the team is terrible again. You know, and it's just like, that's what you do. You go out there, it's cold, you don't even want to be there, half of you doesn't, but you're there, you're there anyway, you know?
And by the third inning, you're so drunk anyway that you feel nothing.
Yeah, which is what happens when I go with other people. So we have beers and then we go sit down in better seats.
So we've been talking a lot about sports, a lot about baseball.
Yes.
And we haven't hit on the big question that I'm sure listeners are now wondering.
Yeah.
Where did the obsession start for you?
Oh, where did the obsession start?
How did it all start with you?
Well, now we get into that really sentimental stuff, right? I mean,
perfect transition.
There's no way to avoid that, I guess.
Segway.
Yeah. Right. Where, I mean, I started going to games with my father when I was, I don't know, 5 years old, probably, maybe younger. And he used to live down by Wrigley Field, maybe 10 miles away or less as a kid. And what he would do is he would caddy for guys at the golf course. He'd make some money and then he'd go with his friends to the game in the afternoon on the weekend. So he'd caddy in the morning and then he'd take his earnings and he'd go over to the ball game. And so, and he had, my father's the ultimate fan. I mean, he has a huge baseball card collection. We've been watching games on TV since I was a kid. And I remember being tiny in my kitchen and listening to the Go Cubs Go theme song on TV and running around the kitchen like a crazy maniac, just, you know, dancing to it as a 3-year-old. And I remember my dad would comb my Barbie's hair while we would sit there and watch the ball game. So, and that was the thing we did together because he watched every game every year. So when it's on in your house as a kid every year, you know, it's kind of hard not to get addicted.
I wish I could say the same about me. My father was really not into sport.
Oh, really?
And nor was my mother. I don't know how I fell into it.
Yeah, I want to know, was it something, did it happen to you in college? Did it happen to you when you moved away from Buffalo?
I guess I can pinpoint it. Tecmo Super Bowl for the NES.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fun as shit game.
Yeah.
And at the time, Buffalo was unstoppable in the AFC. Their last, you know, great moment in the sun until the dark ages hit. They were unstoppable until they got to the, you know, Super Bowl. But and I knew that they were good. And also they were the closest team to where I lived. So I started playing as them and would dominate in the game. And I loved that. And I started paying attention, and by, say, 94 or so, I had the team roster memorized.
Right.
And to this day, I can rattle off, oh, yeah, the linebackers, we had Cornelius Bennett, we had Pete Metlars on tight end. You know, I know all that. And then I kept watching, and I realized, just as you did, the metaphors of the game. And the for me, I'm obsessed with narrative and story.
Right.
And in football and in boxing, I found the best, most dramatic, beautiful stories.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
There was a game a few years ago, the Patriots' undefeated season.
Mm-hmm.
Toward the end of the season, the Ravens had them.
Yeah.
For 3.5 quarters, the Ravens held the Patriots and it looked like they could break it.
Mm-hmm.
The final drive, I sat there and I said, the Ravens, if they can just do something on this drive, as long as nothing goes wrong, they can win this. And I shit you not, every play, it was, you could watch the collapse of the walls of Jericho, basically, like in the Bible. It was like, okay, on this play, boom, that was a, you know, interference call, you know, whatever, like 15-yard penalty. What? On the next play, illegal man on the field, 10-yard penalty. On the next one, fumble, recovery, but a loss of 6 yards. And I'm sitting there going, this cannot be happening. And it was all on one drive. Watching it, and I couldn't believe it, and I was just like, this is the most beautiful thing I've witnessed.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and I think that's part of what is amazing about it, because it's happening live, which so much of our culture now is so edited, right? We can go on the internet. We can show a certain face to our friends, a face to strangers. All the TV is edited. So there's something about it happening there in front of you where you know that anything can really happen right now that makes it really beautiful. Like, I think about watching tennis. Tennis is an amazing game to me because no matter how far down you are, again, it's a game that doesn't have a clock, right? So no matter how far down you are, it's statistically possible that you could always come back. So in men's tennis, you have to win like 3 sets, which it's really crazy. I mean, these tennis matches go on and on, 5 hours, you know, but you have to win 3 sets to win the match. And you could be down 2 sets and 6 games, and you could still come all the way back and win it in 5 sets. And I've seen it happen before, not very often, but I've seen it happen. And you just think, man, a moment, one little momentum shift. And it's such a grinding game that if the momentum just slightly changes, the other guy could just completely run out of gas, you know, and you could win it.
No, I totally understand. I used to watch a lot of tennis when I was in high school. I know exactly what you're talking about. And then I found boxing, which I preferred, not preferred, I should say. I got away from tennis. And, you know, and I would watch Tuesday night fights on USA. Mm-hmm. Not that I'm a big violence fan or something, but there was something wonderful about watching, and Richard Pryor talks about this, There is something so beautiful about watching two men beat the shit out of each other without hurting each other.
Right. Right.
It's such a mental chess game.
Which
at
is
times.
And that's what sports is, right? Because sports can really knock the shit out of you emotionally, but it doesn't really affect your day-to-day life.
No, I'd go into work the next day wearing my Buffalo Bills tie and going, we fucked up again. Or I'll make a snarky remark on Facebook or something about us. But life goes on. I got a grade that afternoon or whatever.
Right.
Prep for class.
Do you think that football is going to go the way of boxing and become sort of the second class sport in the country because of all the injuries and all the basically, I don't know, people just being fucked up for life after playing NFL football?
No. And the reason why is the NFL has too much money of a juggernaut.
Yeah.
It's far too powerful. The only sport that outranks them in the United States is NASCAR.
I didn't even know that was the case.
NASCAR is the number one sport in America.
I do believe it. I can't quite imagine it, but I do believe it.
In terms of revenue and such, they are the biggest sport in America.
Okay.
And second is NFL.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I'd have to check which is bigger, MLB or the NBA.
Yeah, it's probably pretty close down there.
But, of course, then hockey is just down at the bottom.
Sure.
Hockey always gets forgotten about, but... No, I don't see it happening. They've got far too much money, and the moment they renegotiated a contract with a network a few years ago when Monday Night Football jumped from ABC over to ESPN, and the money that was involved to do that was staggering.
Oh, it's just beyond. I mean, the owners, how much money they're raking in football is insane. And the players are totally getting the shit end of the stick because they're the ones who are getting beaten up.
I don't know if you're familiar with it. There's a great documentary series called 30 for 30.
Yes, I am familiar with it.
There is an episode called, I think it's called Going Broke, deals with sports' inability to train young players about money. When these players come into the leagues, in the NFL especially, there's a podcast I listened to with Chris Cluey on it one time where he talked about this. The young players come in, no one's there to explain. This is how you should invest your money in the future. This is how, because you're not going to be doing this forever.
Right.
You may only even do this for 1 year for your life. So this money has to last you life. Yeah, you want to buy a nice car right now. That's great. But have you ever considered buying property and investing in that? And so that's why you see a lot of NFL players go broke, is that they're these young hotshots who come from nothing maybe. Suddenly it's like, I'm going to buy 17 mansions.
Right.
Made out of French fries. I don't care.
I'm going to buy.
Get these old man hearts out of the living room.
No, it's true. And I mean, there are people, of course, my father included in them, who are like, oh, these players, if I was getting paid what they were getting paid, I would be happy for the rest of my life, blah, 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 blah. But I think there's something that's really missing there, right? We're not telling them, we're not talking to them about how to invest the money. We're not talking to them about how precious this moment is. And then beyond that, I mean, just the whatever is going on in their heads to kind of stay afloat in this age of always being on as a celebrity has got to be just, I always tell people, like people say as a poet, I don't know, these are obviously not poets, but other people will tell me, oh, how does it feel to be an author? Like, and people just know you. And I'm like, people don't know me and I don't really want to be famous.
What you should do really in a moment like that is if you know their job, great. If you don't know it, ask them and just be like, so what's it like being blah, blah, blah? You know, oh, so you're a writer? What's it like being a published writer? I don't know. What's it like being third shift busboy at a Denny's?
Right. Right, because I would have no idea.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. What's it like being the district manager for TJ Maxx?
What is the dream job you would like to have for just a day? Like, even if it's a really cruddy job.
If I had the body for it,
mm-hmm.
Professional football.
Oh, right.
If I had the body to do it, I would love to have gone into football and sport. But I don't have the body, I don't have the coordination, I don't have anything. I am a Monday morning quarterback.
Well, you're preaching to the choir with that one. I'm with you there.
You would have done baseball.
No, well, I know it's more like I'm not athletic enough to do it.
Oh, okay.
But no, I really like being a fan. I did play on some softball teams as a kid, but I'm not athletic. But I think I'd like to have a really mundane job, actually, if it was just for a day.
If I could, with the body I've got and everything, mm-hmm. if I could, if, you know, football players out there, I would have loved to do, national radio.
Yes.
Commercial radio, I know. The reason I'm not on commercial and never was is that I don't have the voice for it.
You have a good voice.
I have a good voice.
Yeah.
I do not have a radio voice. Commercial radio voice.
Well, you know something we have in common, Scott, and I don't think you know this, but I was a DJ in college. Now, it's not the same, but I was.
I did not know that.
My name was Screamin' Sandy, which just shows you how immature I was.
Not at all.
But for about 3 years, I was I played the pure rock on FM 89.1 out here in Chicago, and I really loved it. And one thing I kind of still get told at poetry readings, one guy told me that I should be on NPR because I have one of those voices, which just tells me, as much as I love NPR, it just kind of tells me that he could fall asleep to me, maybe. So I don't know about that.
I don't know. Maybe that's how you could help maybe your husband sometime if he's having trouble falling asleep, he's got insomnia or whatever, is just start reading the news to him in an NPR-style voice. I don't know.
I read him poetry sometimes, and he really loves my poetry. He is a supporter of me, but he will fall asleep. The poetry just sounds kind of like a lullaby to him, and he drifts right off.
Hey, so. Whatever works. when I have insomnia, my wife will tell me Star Trek stories or something, and it helps me go to sleep.
Right, because they're probably just sort of comforting, and TA has a great voice, too. I mean, it's a
She doesn't think she does, but she does.
She does, and it's a different sort of voice, too. You know, not everybody sounds like her.
Oh, no.
Which is awesome.
No, so I understand, but no, that's awesome. I did not know you were in college radio.
I was. I mean, I was not. You were a much bigger deal than anything that I
don't know about that. I'm really not all that, to be honest.
I got fired for playing Hell's Bells on the radio, which I think is really ironic because we were playing songs that had a lot worse cursing in them than Hell's Bells, but it was one of the trustee of the colleges, one of the trustees, his least favorite song, and he put it on a do not playlist because he's the trustee and he could do that. And I played it, and that was the end of my college radio career. Hmm. But I said, screw this, it's midnight, no one's gonna hear it.
You never know who's listening.
No, that's the thing, and you have to learn that. So
I learned that my first semester there, I was an apprentice at the station. I was working the 1-4 shift.
Oh, yeah.
In the morning. I was doing graveyard. And you'd be surprised. There are a lot of people, The Simpsons actually makes a joke about it. Who the hell's watching TV at this hour? Alcoholics, the unemployed. And when it came to radio, you had third shift busboys at Denny's.
Right.
Maybe we're listening to the college station. There were a lot of people out there still listening at 2 in the morning.
Did you ever have the local beat cops call in to make requests?
No, but I got my request,
Okay.
but I did have the campus newspaper one semester. They
Oh.
published on Tuesdays. I was on Monday evenings in prime time. They would come in and be like, they didn't clear this with the station management, if I recall right, and they said, "Can we do the headlines for tomorrow's issue on your show?" And I just decided, let's go with it. So what became the joke then is they come in like, "Hi, we're from Pipe." They show up at the door, and I'd be like, "Oh, great, Pipe Dream's here." And I'd look at my cast members and be like, "Ready on it? Ready." And I'd be like, "All right, ladies and gentlemen, so Pipe Dream has just come in again." And I would start playing, if you've ever watched the movie, Manos, the Hands of Fate. I would play their theme song in the background of do 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 in the background. And then it became, they got so comfortable with me that they would come on, they'd be like, "So tomorrow's headlines in Pipe Dream, blah blah blah," and then I would start interjecting and asking them questions about the headlines and such, and they got to be a nice little banter. So in the end it was okay, but yeah, just that was the closest I ever got.
Yeah, I mean, I just loved hearing the cops or the guy working in the Target warehouse that would call in and say, "Please, please, can you play Pink by Aerosmith?" You know, at 3 in the morning. And actually, one of the Target warehouse boys had a real, we had a little bit of a tete-a-tete going on for a while where he would call in and say, "You know, you should stop by Target at 6 in the morning. I'll be there and we should meet when your shift is over." And it went on for a few months, but ultimately I decided this is a bad idea. I should not meet this guy.
I totally understand where you're coming from with that. So,
Yes.
did you ever have really interesting requests like that? Any request stories that beyond that that really just kind of stick with you?
I'm trying to think of something in particular. I remember playing, I think it was, I remember someone requesting, we used to play actually when we needed to go to the bathroom, we would play "Do You Feel Like We Do?" You know, Peter Frampton. So we, because it's a college radio station, so the song is 11 minutes long, whatever, you could get away with it. But one time someone asked me to play the entire B-side of Dark Side of the Moon, which I did. And I got in some major trouble for this. Again, this was at 3 in the morning. And I think the trouble really came not just because I played the B-side, but because I think I let it slip that during the time that I was playing the B-side, I was sleeping on the nasty green couch in the recording studio.
Oh, the
So
college radio couches. I have my stories. You have not lived until you have crashed out on one of those for a night.
I mean, sometimes you just did not go to bed. You didn't do anything. You're like, "I'm going to do it 2 to 6 a.m. I can handle it. I don't need to go to sleep at 8 and get sleep before I do this."
Who needs sleep?
I never slept before the shift. So I'm like, okay, this B-side is 30 minutes long. Okay, I can definitely sleep for 25 minutes at least. And I need that to get through the rest of the shift.
I did it once. I think it was a 17-hour, or did I do a full 24? I don't remember, of nothing but Frank Zappa.
Oh my gosh.
And around 2 in the morning or so, I put on a Rare bootleg album on vinyl and just let it run and pass the fuck out. And but I was thinking, I was like, I have one great request. I have That was actually a great one because I do have a request story from that.
Okay.
I had posted something about it on Usenet, the old Usenet servers. And so midway through the marathon, I get this call, and it's this heavy accented voice. And I'm like, okay. He's like, "Hello, you are playing Zappa." And I was like, "Yes, I am." And he's like, "Oh, very good, very good. I listen in Germany. It's very good." And the guy was calling in from Germany
Oh my God,
to
amazing.
tell me that he was loving this. And he's like, "Could you play," and he inserts Rare song, and I'm like, "Actually, yes, I can do that for you, my man." It reminds me, I have one other request story, and that is, I was doing a, I play I started doing obscure classic rock that they weren't playing on the classic rock stations to for fun. And so I played a song called Arizona. It's by Mark Lindsey, 1970. He was part of Paul Revere and the Raiders. That's just that's just who I am. I'm a nerd about this.
He loves Paul Revere and the Raiders.
Who does?
My father, one
Oh.
of his favorite bands.
Okay. So I play this track, and then a week later, I get a call in the middle of my show, and it's this guy, you know, middle-aged voice, is like, "Hey, Scott C., last week you played a song about Arizona." I'm like, "Yeah, by Mark Lindsay." He's like, "Could you play that again?" I'm like, "Yeah, I could do that." "Why, man?" He's like, "Oh, I heard it for the first time in ages, and it just took me back to junior high." Uh-huh. And I made it, you know, tried to make it, you know, a little bit of levity. I'm like, "Oh, sorry to bring up some old memories for you, some bad ones." He's like, "No, man, those are the best years of my life." And I felt like I've got to play it for him then, because this is like bringing him back to he even said it was math class detention that he remembers hearing it. And I was like,
"Oh my God."
I'm like, "I got to bring you back, man." So, so here you go. This one's for you, man. Boom.
Because who doesn't want to come back to math class detention? I mean, Jesus.
Well, maybe he had really good friends and.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know. We are almost out of time. I cannot believe this.
Yeah, no, we've had a good time here. I'm feeling great about this.
I have enjoyed this conversation.
I'm glad.
You have set the bar now for anybody who comes on and wants to talk sport.
Okay, that makes me feel good. Like I didn't have to legitimize myself because I'm a woman or something. You know.
You've set the bar. You've set the bar. So anybody who comes on about sport, they got to be equal in your knowledge of the Cubs.
But I love this because now when I listen to the SAFTAcast, hopefully there will be someone who wants to talk sports, because I've really enjoyed the SAFTAcast and all the totally disparate.
Well, there is someone I have in mind for the future who may rival you or exceed you in knowledge of baseball.
Okay.
So we'll have to see what that happens. I'm thinking
it better be Vin Scully, because I hope he's the only one who's exceeding me.
No, you know? I have a friend of mine, a very close friend, who is not a writer, but a very close friend of mine who is a diehard Dodgers fan.
Oh, yes. Okay.
And can slaughter people when it comes to the Dodgers.
Okay. Well, that's fine. I mean, I'm not interested in slaughtering. I'm interested in spreading love, so.
Although there was a player for the Pittsburgh Pirates, a catcher named Don Slott.
Yes, I remember.
And that is the greatest name I have ever heard.
It's right up there, along with a neighbor that I had named Terry Taco.
Ooh.
Yeah, so.
Well, if we're staying in baseball, we got Raleigh Fingers.
Yeah, Raleigh Fingers.
Gotta throw him in.
Yeah, there's a lot of good ones. I mean, I know Ron Santo, one of the broadcasters for the Cubs for many, many years, and actually Harry Carey, too, were famous for butchering pronunciations, particularly for the Latin players. So there was this player the Cubs had called Altonia Alfonseca, Antonio Alfonseca. And every time you heard the name, I mean, I'm even butchering it because I think every time I heard it, it was butchered.
Or Tug McGraw.
Tug McGraw. Well,
and so the fact that his first name is Tug.
Oh, that, no. I mean, how could you do better than that? You know.
I go back to Don Slott, you know.
Yeah, there are just people that you just know because of their name. They're born to do what they're doing, you know.
Yeah, although it's not his birth name, I still think Trombone Shorty is one of the best band names out there.
Trombone Shorty. I like
it. And it's a good band, too. I enjoy it. But anyway, it has been a pleasure talking with you, Sandy.
Yes. Great talking to you, Scott, and I will be listening to this aftercast and promoting it to my friends.
All right. Well, you keep doing that. We're slowly gaining traction.
Yes. Oh, you are. And you're going to have listeners for this one, because I'm going to threaten people to the point of listening.
That's a good idea. I look forward to the threats.
Well, you have a wonderful night then.
You do. You take care of yourself. Before you go, though, is there anything coming up in the near future that you want to plug?
I do. Yeah, sure. Why not? So I have a new letterpress chapbook out right now called A Detail in the Landscape, which is actually why I went down to Knoxville to read in the SAFTA, the award-winning SAFTA reading series, which was a totally kick-ass experience. And so there are a few copies of that left. And if you want one, you can friend me on Facebook or friend my professional page, which is Sandra Marchetti's Writing Services. And then I have a book coming out on Goldwake Press in December, my first full-length collection. So I'm really excited about that. It's called Confluence. And so it's been a good writing year, which Excellent. Is probably why I've been asked to do this, because people, you know, I'm pestering people for these gigs because I want to promote this stuff, but also because I want to talk to fine folks like you. So.
Oh, well, thank you. And not have to worry about, well, I should talk about the book then, shouldn't I?
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And what I told Aaron and TA was, what I like most about this SAFTAcast thing was how you just came out and said it, that this is not going to help your writing at all. We're not even going to talk about it. Because, really, writers need this, too. We can't be serious all the time and just talk about prosody. You know?
When is the only other... I can't think of another interview outlet right now that you're going to be able to talk about your love of baseball for an hour.
Yeah, probably not. And no one else would really tolerate it or bring in their own commentary. So
actively want to hear about it and be like, so why the Cubs? Why?
And isn't that a gift that someone just kind of wants to listen to you ramble on about your totally irrational love for this horrible sports team?
I didn't even get to ask you about the GOAT theory.
Oh,
let's save that for another day.
Yes, absolutely.
Let's put that for another one. So it has been a pleasure having you on, and the folks can find you on the Facebook, on your professional site. Can they find you on the Twitter?
I'm not on the Twitter, but I think I'm going to be forced into it pretty soon.
Yeah, it kind of had to be with this show, too.
Yeah, so I think everything that I'm listed under is like Sandra Poetry. So if I ever have a Twitter, I'm going to try to have Sandra Poetry.
Okay.
But I'm going to try to have my sanity first before I get Twitter.
I totally understand. Well, we'll be on the lookout for you. Thank you again for being here. It was awesome talking with you.
Yeah, great talking to you too, Scott.
All right, take care. Have a good evening.
Bye, you too.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.